You're listening to the NCF&B Podcast. The North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast takes you behind the scenes of North Carolina's food and beverage industry. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at NCFB Pod, presented by Food Scene. That's food, SEEN.com. Providing professional photography, social media management, video production, and website design. And now, enjoy the show.
Thank you for listening to the NCF&B Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And today we have some local boys made good. So from the 18 restaurant group, the chef, proprietor, and owner, Chef Jason Smith, and his young Padawan, Chef Jake Wood. Welcome, gents.
I like it.
Hey, good morning.
Nice. Nice Star Wars reference.
Yes. Yeah. I dig that.
I'm not Obi-Wan Kenobi yet, am I?
I don't know. I don't see a cloak on you or a lightsaber, but you might have it hidden somewhere.
And Obi usually had the beard, so yeah. I don't know.
I've got the wrinkles.
Well, welcome, gents. Welcome into the studio, and excited to have you both here. Thank you. If you live in the Raleigh Triangle, the Triangle area, you've probably seen some of Jason's restaurants around 18 Seaboard, Harvest 18, Cantina 18. Anything with an 18. If it's got an 18 on it, he owns it.
Yeah, which is why we're recording this episode on July 18th.
That's right. Nice.
Yeah, yeah. That was perfect.
Lucky, actually, right. Lucky number 18.
That's right.
Yeah. And then, of course, Jake, we kind of even know each other from way back in the day. We used to be rivals.
Right across the street.
Oh, right across the street. We used to battle.
Yeah.
So what I'm kidding around about is that there was, if you go back to North Hills and back in the days when I was at Midtown Grill, Jake, you were the sushi chef at Cowfish.
Correct.
And I believe, not that I had anything directly to do with it, but our chef at the time, Ben Harris, went toe-to-toe in the Iron Man brunch challenge.
Brunch battle, yep.
Brunch battle, of which I believe you won.
I think Ben, well, they had, it wasn't like first, second, third, it was like people's favorite, judge's favorite, so on and so forth, but it was a good time, man. It was like the first time I had ever done anything like that, and it was really cool.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely was fun, and we were like super intimidated because Jake had like Terminator sunglasses on, and like it was like a leather apron. It was like super nice.
Yeah, it was
thick
like the fish butcher apron, man.
Yeah.
Did you pull up in a big motorcycle as well?
I did not. Okay. No, I pulled up in a GMC Terrain.
But he did look at us and gave us like the cuts right there.
Oh,
like, don't
man.
Talk. We're like, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Right.
No, but it was fun. And then from there, we kind of I had seen what had been growing with your career as time had gone on. But let's do that. Let's talk about both you guys, at least like from the beginning, and get started. But Chef Jason Smith, let's start with you. Where did it all start, sir?
No. It seems like every major chef in this area comes off the Magnolia Grill tree lately.
I had a great run at Magnolia Grill. It was a very fortunate experience to work with Ben and Karen and the team there. And I got at the Magnolia Grill at a perfect time for me. I was ready for structure, and I definitely needed some structure. There's no doubt about it. And Ben's pretty good at giving you that. And I love the sourcing local. It was something I had never even thought of prior to the first day I walked in that kitchen. And people didn't really talk about it. He just did it. So yeah, I had a great 5-year run at Magnolia Grill.
Take us back real quick, because you're a Raleigh boy, born and raised, right?
I was born in Raleigh, and my mom moved to Wilmington, so I was back and forth between Raleigh and Wilmington. My dad was here, actually living just a few short steps from Cameron Village, where the cantina is now.
Gotcha.
And in high school, I worked in some restaurants in Wilmington, and really the week after I left Wilmington to move to Raleigh after I graduated from high school, barely graduated from high school. It was more like they released me.
Understood.
Told me to go about my business. I landed at, I actually worked for a short amount of time at the Brugger's on Hillsborough Street, which was pretty cool. And that transitioned to the Big Sky Bread Company, which you guys may not know about. It was in Cameron Village, Scratch Bakery, and I worked there in the morning, and the 40 Deuce at night, the 42nd Shore Shore, which Jake has also worked at.
You guys have that in kin. Yeah,
we were there at different times. He was like 10 when I was there.
So the restaurant business or getting into it came apart as kind of needing a job, like, because your dad was an attorney, right?
He is an attorney. Yeah, he practices law still, but I enjoyed the interaction with people, and I enjoyed the adrenaline, and I can't sit still very long. Like, sitting through this podcast is going to be the most I sit down probably for a month.
Well, we can get a George Foreman grill right in front of you, and you can start cooking some stuff up for us.
We can also put like a Britney Spears microphone headset. You could just walk around.
That might happen.
That'd be rad.
Yeah.
So it was a combo job, but also I liked it. And then when I was at the Oyster Bar and seeing, you know, learning kind of about the Yours and the Angus Barn and Brad Hurley, and, you know, seeing you could make a living out of this, and it was a career, and, you know, watching Brad walk around and talk to customers, that really opened it up for me to try to treat it more like a career. And, you know, one of the things I try to say to folks at Seaboard that work there, you know, let's be honest, most people aren't there for it to be their career. But if it's something you do, if you're in the restaurant business, you know, 3, 4, 5 years on the next step to do whatever, well, 5 years is a big chunk of the time that you're earning a living. Yeah. And Seaboard, without a doubt, the more you treat it like a career, the more it will treat you like a career. And that's something I try to stay focused on is, you know, what you'll get out of it, what you put into it a lot of times.
Yeah, just a quick sidebar. I always I worked for Chef David Boulay for a while, and one of the nuggets that always stick with me in my head is that he would have former employees write him letters about what they're doing now, and one woman in particular, I can't remember what she's doing exactly, is very successful, but wrote him a letter that she basically was working for him just to make money and get, you know, do something, and he said something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing, that, well, you're here, and this might not be your career, but if you do this right, it will set in place the practices for whatever you do in the rest of your life that you will be committed to. And she wrote a letter, suffice it to say, saying that advice made me commit to that and set in place my work ethic, essentially, totally, for the rest of my career.
No doubt.
We say that to people all the time. Like, when we've said it before on the show, too, but, you know, back in L.A., when waiters were also aspiring actors, and they're just like kind of half-assing their server job.
Yeah.
I would then call them out and say, so when was the last time you got your headshots renewed? Like, you just got a haircut, so does your headshot look like your new haircut? No. When was the last time you met with your agent or your manager? How many auditions do you go through in a week? I'm like, oh, so you're a horrible actor as well as a horrible waiter. I didn't say it as cruel, but that's kind of what I meant in my
head.
You're
kind of being a dick about it,
though. Oh, totally. But hopefully, so, and, you know, and George Clooney always remembers that day and always gives me credit. Had I not said it to a young Clooney.
Good old Clune Dogs.
Look, man, get on Facts of Life. It will change your life.
He's going to be on the podcast next week, right?
Yeah, well, he's suffering from a motorcycle injury in Italy. So
yeah, so we had to cancel postpone.
That'll come up in a few months. Good practices are always that way. And so even let's transition a little to Jake. So good practices, I think of a super disciplined chef. When I think of a super disciplined chef, I think of a sushi chef. I think of somebody that just, like, they live and die and breathe by, like, perfection and excellence. And that's at least how I had known you for a long time. And we can get deeper into it as we go. But how does that formulate, and how did you become so inspired into getting into Asian food at a young age?
I kind of fell into it. I worked at the Oyster Bar.
Yeah.
I shucked oysters there. Before that, I worked helping my dad run his landscape business. We built a golf course down on the Albemarle Sound. It was an Arnold Palmer golf course, and we lived down there for 3.5 years.
Must have been eating some great seafood down there.
Yeah, man. It was a really good time, and it was a great experience. And at that point in my life, I thought that's what I was going to be doing. And then the recession hit, and all golf course construction pretty much stopped. All the jobs we had bids in on just were no more. And my dad got me linked up. He's a good friend of Hunter, who's a GM at the Oyster Bar still. Got me linked up. I started shucking oysters up there, and I really liked the vibe and the flow of the kitchen and was really intrigued by it. So I spoke to the chef, Dave Greenwell, and just asked him, hey, said, you know, next time you have an opening in the kitchen, instead of looking, you know, for somebody else to hire, just holler at me. I'd love to, you know, transition into the kitchen. And, you know, that kind of really sparked my interest in food and kind of got my life revolving around food. And I started, you know, trying to learn more and read more books and so on and so forth. And I've always loved Asian food. I started really liking sushi after high school, and I kind of fell into it, man, to be honest with you. My mother-in-law owned a restaurant in Salisbury. We lived in Salisbury for about 3 years. My daughter was born. Me and my wife moved there probably 2010, I believe.
Okay.
And she had a restaurant, and it was like Southern Asian fusion. It had sushi, and I took it over. She bought it from somebody, and we basically took over the business and kind of made some tweaks and changes, hired some new sushi chefs and whatnot. And I learned a lot from them, but I still really didn't understand it. But when that stopped, we really wanted to move back this direction or to Charlotte, you know, somewhere with a little bit more opportunity than Salisbury. And I was good friends from the Oyster Bar with Stephen Koster, who is now with the Cowfish and was at the time. So I reached out to him. I knew they had an opening for a head chef position. I was kind of a little bit too big for my britches, but, you know, I was going to go for it. And so I went in, I talked to him, and come to find out they had already hired a fellow, Jason Malone, who's a area chef for Tupelo now.
Yeah.
And they had a sushi chef position open. And at the time, I thought it was going to be in Charlotte, which I was okay with. So they sent me to Charlotte, put me up in a hotel room for 35 days or something like that, and I just trained straight. With their master sushi chef, Rafali Amunir, who was the executive sushi chef for the Grand Hyatt in Bali for, I think, 20 years or so.
Oh, wow.
He's Indonesian. And he is, like, the sensei of, like, what I did in sushi, man. Like, everything that I needed to know, that guy taught me. You know, he taught me the all the way down to the soul of it. You know, your knife is your soul, and it's an extension of yourself. And just how to treat every movement. And it was something that I never really knew existed, you know, and I respected what he did so much, and really I wanted to be like him, you know what I mean? I wanted to look like that while I was doing it, and I wanted to have the knowledge that he had, so I made it a strong point to just follow in his footsteps and learn everything I could from him, learn from the people who were working under me that had been doing it longer than me, and you know, I kind of it was really humbling, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of like starting over. You know, I've always been able to cook. I've always had a pretty decent palate in my mind, but that was something totally out of my you know, realm. And a lot of white boys don't really do sushi, man. So you got a lot of weird looks from people. you know, I'd go to interview a fellow from Japan who was, you know, coming in for a sushi chef job up at our bar, and he would look at me like, you know, just the craziest looks, man.
What the hell do you know about sushi?
Yeah, but it was something I really took a lot of pride in, and working at the Cowfish and doing that and having that structure and that discipline is kind of, you know, what pushed me to be able to kind of be thrown in any kind of atmosphere and adapt. And I mean, you're doing $15,000 worth of sushi a day. You got a robot that's putting your rice sheets out because that's how much sushi you do. I mean, it's high volume, doing really, like, tedious hands-on work.
Yeah. Cowfish has never been struggling for business.
No, Lord, no. I went there not too long ago. It's crazy.
Busy.
It is.
For those that don't understand or know what we're talking about, because obviously Cowfish has locations, I think, in Charlotte and here in Raleigh.
And now Atlanta and Birmingham.
Yeah, they're starting
one
to expand.
One in Disney World, although it's franchise, I think.
Yeah, Universal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or but Universal. This is a sushi/burger fusion restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can even get the burgushi, right?
Burgushi,
so
yeah.
Like burger sushi, which, you know, like if you don't want all the carbs or the gluten, it's a good way to go, right?
It's kind of
like
a gluten-free burger. It's actually really good. It's a novelty item, but it's done extremely well.
It's not bad.
And yeah. It's a local owned restaurant, too.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah,
Marcus Hall is a good regular at Seaboard. His mom and dad are as well. So, good people.
Yeah. Definitely. And it's funny, not to talk so much about
this episode brought to you by Cowfish.
Thank you, Cowfish. We should take a moment because this episode is brought to you by another local product.
Yeah, by Social House Vodka, and I believe you guys are friendly with Social House Vodka as well. Social House Vodka is based in Kinston, North Carolina, and it's, you know, gluten-free. It's made from fresh water from the Black Creek Aquifer.
Locally sourced corn from Kinston.
And it's made with people that understand the restaurant business, like our good friend G. Patel, who's come up through the restaurant industry as well and had restaurants all over the triangle, so it's good product and good people are behind it. So
yeah,
I think it's super reasonably priced for what it is. Mm-hmm. To have a local product that is I think, comparable to other products on the same level, but are probably 20 or 30% more expensive.
No doubt. I was shocked when I went into the ABC store and saw how inexpensive it was compared to all of its market. You know, I was like, oh, it's $19.99 for last I checked. And yeah. So it's like...
No, I think it's actually $19.95.
Oh, that's right.
Don't forget about those 4 cents.
9.5 plus 4 pennies. Add that shit up. But it's a good value. It's a damn good vodka. So that's in your gift bags, by the way, the NCFMB gift bag. So enjoy that. You guys will have to split that bottle tonight. So
I believe this will be out later, but tonight, as this episode airs, you will be having a dinner at 18 Seaboard for Social House.
You're doing a Social House dinner tonight, and trust me, for being friends with G and all I got's one lousy bottle of vodka, that's not a very good deal.
Seriously, what's up with that, G? What's up with the frugality, though?
Oh, I might have to give him a double magnum that's behind me right now.
Well, after he hears this, I have a feeling a case might show up at your house. Yeah. Can't show up at your place of business. But I wanted to get back to that idea of the cowfish, not to talk about them, but the fact that people have the impression that they're very big and they're an empire, but I think they only have like 5 or 6 restaurants going. And then transition that to you, Jason, because you now have 4 total restaurants, right?
That's 4. Correct. Yep.
The perception is that this is like small independent business.
Small
right?
independent business, exactly. Yeah. And then I'm wondering, because we also didn't touch on your background, also includes some stints with the Union Square Hospitality with Danny Meyer at Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern. Did that inspire you? And like, just take us into a little bit of the history of creating 18 Seaboard and coming back to Raleigh.
Well, when I had that long tour at the Magnolia Grill, I wanted to do something different, and there wasn't a lot of choices in the Triangle at that time. You could go to Nana's or Farrington, there maybe Bloomsbury. There were a handful of spots. And I knew that I wanted to get out of the area while I could. And I had gone and done some stages in New York at La Bernardin and Cafe Balloud, just on vacation time for like 2 days, nothing too intense. So I decided to move to New York. My sister was already there, who's 5 years younger, and her and I ended up sharing a studio. I didn't have a job, and Union Square wasn't my first choice. The places I was trying to get jobs, I couldn't get in. And
they hadn't opened a cowfish up there yet.
They had not, no. Anyway, I kind of just cold called Union Square, like on the basement door, and the chef at the time there, the sous chef's a guy named Kenny Callahan. He ended up opening Blue Smoke for Danny. And Kenny like put me to work a few hours later. I was like filling out paperwork and working at Union Square, which I needed to. The time clock was ticking. And I liked the job, but it wasn't until about 5 or 6 days later. Danny at that time, he had 4 restaurants, was still doing a new hire meeting with every single new hire. And I knew when I sat down and talked to Danny and heard his spiel for 15 minutes, he basically wrapped up setting the table in a 15 minute spiel, and that's what I was looking for.
Yeah,
I'd had this back of the house chef experience that I needed from Ben, but I needed a little more well rounded business and seeing the bigger picture. And that guy definitely sees the big picture, and so immediately I just fell into that culture and fell in love with it. I'm friends to this day with some of those folks and dozens of them, and to be honest, exact, and spent time at Union Square, and then was able to move over to Gramercy, which was pretty awesome as well. But the Union Square, the healthiness of that is something I've tried to portray in our company. And when I came back to Raleigh, I didn't have the idea of opening a multi-concept restaurant group, and quite frankly, I don't know that I recommend that to anybody anymore. It's kind of a dying trade. It's really hard to do. It's not the easiest thing. It's not always the smartest thing to do with your time either. There's a lot of things I could do with my time that would be less, intense.
Yeah, but who wants to do that?
Yeah, I know.
You did it because you wanted to do it.
I wanted to do it. And I also get to do this. I don't have to. I get to. It's a luxury, and it's something I don't take for granted, and I'm very thankful. And I've had a lot of help along the way. But what I try to say to young people is, I didn't just wake up one day with 4 restaurants. I like learn garmage and then learn roast and then learn grill and then learn how to be a sous chef and then learn how to run 1 restaurant before I tried to run 2. And right now I'm learning how to run 4, and I'm not going to try to run 5 unless I know that I can run 4. you know, Seaboard had some lucky breaks, man. We, when we opened that restaurant, we didn't have the gallery space next to it. And we had a great art gallery next door, and we started using, we partnered with them, and we started hosting some events in there. And those took off, and the owner of the art gallery decided she wanted to move more in the core downtown. And it was a no-brainer to take that space over. And that kind of happened at the same time we were signing the Cantina lease, which was in the middle of the recession. And it was just a bizarre time, you know, for us, because A, we're like doubling the size of our company, adding on to an existing restaurant. And we kind of, Seaboard fell in this little niche where we were less expensive than some of the national brand steakhouses. And we were very hands-on in trying to give a high-end experience to folks. So it felt very, the value was there for customers.
Yeah.
And our business flourished. And, you know, when we opened the Cantina, nobody thinks about this, but that first year, man, the Cantina was lost money, and it was a struggle, and we didn't have the bandwidth just to lift up and carry a restaurant along. And, you know, there's nothing quite as humbling as taking money out of one business and putting it into another business. You don't even see it. And, you know, there's so much that goes into that, too, tax consequences and whatnot, that it was just a really bizarre time for my wife and I. And then all of a sudden, one day, it was like the bleeding just stopped, and that restaurant took off, and it got better, and it got good. And you know, you look back on those moments and you're like, man, would I do that again? Do I have the balls to do that? Or would I put my family through that again? You know, but at the same time, you want to like try to empower the people that are around you, that you know that they can go do that. You know, one of the more gratifying things in my career is somebody that has worked at one of the businesses that now is pulling in a six-figure income somehow, some way, whether it's in the restaurant business or something else. And that to me, you know, was taught, I think, through Ben and Karen and Union Square Hospitality, without a doubt.
So can you pinpoint that moment at Cantina 18 when it switched and it started making money?
Oh, man.
Or what it was?
Probably 10, 11 months. I think people finally understood it, and people weren't walking in expecting a traditional type of Mexican restaurant in the Triangle, and they also weren't expecting it to be 18 Seaboard. It's not 18 Seaboard. It's fast-paced. It's loud. But people went in there with the expectation levels of Seaboard, and, you know, whether we like it or not, a lot of a clientele at Seaboard is expecting like a Ritz-Carlton experience.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really hard to do when you're selling catfish for, at that time, $15 a plate.
Right.
So that was kind of the cross we bear, though, and that's what made the business work. And that was a good niche for us to find, and it still is. It's kind of amazing how few what I consider fine dining restaurants are in Raleigh. There are high-end, cool restaurants that are doing really good food, but they're not necessarily fine dining. The kitchen's open. It's loud. It's a different experience, the gastropub.
I want to touch on that, and I'm glad you brought this up and moving ahead in the conversation. And I want to get back to some more of that, but you mentioned fine dining. 18 Seaboard is a white tablecloth restaurant.
It's right on the edge. We don't have white tablecloths at the dining room. They're wooden tops.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, and to be honest with you, 20% of the people pay 80% of our bills. It is based on regulars, and there's people that eat there two and three times a week, but that once a year anniversary is real important as well.
Yeah.
Well, that 80-20 rule is pretty common for most successful businesses, and you're always trying to expand upon out, but it's good that you have that 20% that's loyal, and that's how you cultivate longevity in your business.
But that the Seaboard, though, is seen by the large majority of the public as a once a year special occasion. But in reality, it's really not what it is. It is that, but it's not what keeps us going. But
yeah.
But that's an important component, and one that I take real seriously. If somebody's coming to me on their 20th wedding anniversary, man, that is a serious deal. And that needs to go right. If somebody sees their CEO once a year who flies in from Norway and they're having dinner at 18 Seaboard, that dinner needs to be dead on.
Yeah.
And it's at Cantina, if it's not, you can be like, hey, tacos are on us, and they're giving you a hug and thanking you, and, man, this is the greatest restaurant ever. It's Seaboard. They don't want it for free. What they want it is right.
Yeah. It's the expectation.
Yeah, that's right.
But Seaboard has been open since 2006, right? And you mentioned that other restaurants, Raleigh, Triangle, all around the country, really, they're doing high-quality food, really good service, but it's in a very casual atmosphere. Obviously, you saw a need for a little bit of a refresh, And in my mind, that's the reason for this man sitting to your right, because he's more of like the hip, young, tatted chef coming from making sushi and maybe brings a little edge to the restaurant. Take us through the partnership with Jake came on and bringing him on board.
The first day that Jake came in and kind of do a stage, first of all, Marcus had recommended Jake, and I think really highly of Marcus going back to the Cowfish. Hopefully they'll be a sponsor since we mentioned their name so many times.
Steven's a listener, so.
Yeah, and they can afford it, so yeah, I can put the hard press on Marcus. But anyway, it was an interesting day. I had become very focused on opening restaurants, and we went on kind of an opening restaurant spree there for a little while, redoing Cantina and so forth and so forth. And Seaboard has sold really well. I mean, it's been very consistent, and I don't want to say that I neglected it. I just got really focused on doing other things.
Sure.
And it felt like it was time for me or someone to put some attention into it and just say, okay, what's going on here? Let's, keep doing what I try to do in a good restaurant is you don't make changes, you make improvements. And as long as we're making improvements, we're going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Changes can really raise an eyebrow with your regulars and make them very, unnerved. And, mm-hmm. they want to share in this, shared ownership. It's a Danny Meyer fundamental, and they want to share in it. So, make a long story short, we were actually doing a pretty high-end, heavy hors d'oeuvre cocktail party, and one of the folks attending the party and sponsoring it was the Ashley Farms, Joyce Foods folks.
Oh, yeah.
So I told Jake, come in. We've got some cool stuff, cool product to use.
That was his first interview, meeting?
The very first meeting. A Tasmanian devil erupted in this kitchen of 18 Seaboard. He didn't know where a Rondo was or, up from down. I mean, he had never stepped foot in there. And I was there, and he immediately got what we're trying to do, which is use the best ingredients we can and don't mess them up. That's an old Ben Barker saying, except he didn't use the word mess. I'll spare the language.
I think we can infer.
Yeah, and also we didn't make it an intellectual test. I mean, it was clever and really tasty, but it didn't take away from, like, hey, this is Joyce Foods product too. He can do that if he wanted to, but that's not what we're trying to do. And it was like one of those moments where he and I were both at the end of the day smiling. Things went well. It was very well received, and it just felt like a good fit at the time.
Hmm. Talk about knocking it out of the park in your first interview.
It was knocking it out of the park. But let's all remind ourselves, cooking food is kind of the easy part. Being a chef and running a business is what's really, really hard.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
That's where it's been really good for both of us, I think. So I can make... he can make some beautiful food that's been very well received by our clientele and helped elevate the restaurant, and it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll have to say, when it was announced that Chef Jake Wood came on at 18 Seaboard, it felt like it didn't seem like it was just like, oh, another new hire at an existing restaurant and whatever. There was a lot of pride and importance about this, and a great support coming from you, Jason, but also coming from the community. It was like everyone embraced it and went, yeah, like, this guy's been doing some really good food locally, and now he's here at a beloved place. This is going to be great. And I remember Matt and I, we dined when it was like your first like week that you had just been there, and we brought the ladies, and we had an excellent meal, mm-hmm. and it was fun. There's something that Chef Jason Smith has always done, and it's something that I had to take a page out of that, and hopefully I did it as much as possible. But Jason, you touch every single table that I've ever seen in the restaurant since the moment that it opens to the moment it closes. And what I mean by that, you don't just like walk by and touch a table. You go by and you say hello to every single person. And it was just phenomenal to me to see just the hospitality vibe and gene be so evident in how you do business, and I think it's no wonder why you're successful what you do, and then be able to continue that. But then, having only known Jake as my enemy in the brunch battle, I didn't know his personality too much, but then it was like just this openness and warmth once we walked in, and humbleness. Just like,
yeah.
I really hope you guys enjoy what we've done here tonight. And since then, and we've now seen each other at food festivals and various things,
definitely.
It's still that same driving force that that exudes. So let me ask you, Jake, what was your side of the story when you were going here? Like, why did you, for lack of a better term, why did you apply for this job, and what made 18 Seaboard so interesting to you, and how has that kind of positioned you as a chef now?
Sure. I've always known 18 Seaboard. I never got a chance to dine at 18 Seaboard up until, you know, when I started working there, but I always knew it as kind of the cat's meow in Raleigh. You know, before there was Pools or Crawford or Standard or anything like that, there was always 18 Seaboard, and I knew that it was, you know, at the top. And so I was very excited to obviously, with his reputation, I heard a lot of good things from Marcus, the cowfish again. But yeah, it was something that I was very excited about, and I also knew that at that point in my career, kind of like Jason was explaining, I was really looking for somebody to kind of learn from on the business end of things. You know, I can cook you any kind of food you want to, and that's, like he said, the easy part.
Yeah.
But learning how to run a business that's bigger than just a couple people, learning how to motivate people, treat people the right way, learning from him how to treat your customers and what's you know, received well from the customers. It's all things that I was kind of looking for and needed in my career as kind of a quote-unquote hopeful final step before, you know, I break out on my own. And Jason and I were, you know, I was clear with him about that from the start, and he's probably my, you know, biggest supporter in the community for me doing that. But you know, in the meantime, we're having a great time working together. I'm learning from him. He's given me pretty much total freedom to really stretch my legs and see what I can do, see what the best way to manage people, you know, is, that works for me. And so that's something I'm very grateful for and was very hopeful for coming to 18 Seaboard. So now being there for a year and having been able to do all that and continue to do that, I've had a lot of opportunities, you know, put in my lap by Jason. And I think that it's really going to help me when I get out on my own. I'm gonna take a lot from Jason and from what I've learned from his company. So.
So what's your food cost and your payroll running right now? No, I'm kidding.
Oh, God bless. That's another conversation. We're working on
better,
it. We're working on it.
Better.
Better. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
What's so is there a big change from, say, running more of an Asian-inspired restaurant to more of a traditional French technique restaurant?
Obviously, the technique is a lot different. The skill set has to be a little bit different, but I think what I took from being in sushi is the discipline, the cleanliness, the organization is something that I strive for. And we're not there and might not ever get there, but it's something that I feel like I was able to bring into a different atmosphere and incorporate, and it kind of clicked and worked well. Now, there's things that obviously are done in an Asian atmosphere or sushi atmosphere that can't work in our atmosphere, you know.
Give me an example. Like what?
You don't get to do shots of sake in the middle of
service.
Well,
that, you know, and you know, one of the biggest things I liked about working sushi is I was able, if I chose to, I could go and I could interact with folks while making their food, which is just creating an even better memory for them, which is a big reason why I do what I do, is to create memories for people. So, you know, obviously in the high pace, high volume kitchen that we're working in, we're back there, we're sweating, we're grinding, we're dirty. You know, you're not face to face with a customer.
And, yeah.
And I do try to take, you know, any chance I can to run somebody's food, go out and ask somebody how the hell they're doing, ask if they need anything else from the kitchen, you know, so on and so forth. But I think that's something that obviously can't translate into what we're doing, just because it's more of a, even though that was high volume, it's more of a personalized, they have the 12 seats at the bar. You know, I can go and I can touch every single customer if I want to, and really personalize their meal, personally hand them, you know, what I've just created. And that's something that goes with sushi all around the world. That's part of it. The omakase
this is where,
style,
like,
the, you know, that's something that is in that world. And in this world, you know, nobody knows what's going on behind the scenes. And what they see is just this portrayal of, you know, who knows what's in their head. It's kind of like when I came to 18 Seaboard, man, I was envisioning just this, like, mecca of of place, and it is, but you know, it's just kind of like we're back there, nobody knows what we're doing. Yeah. They see the finished product, and they don't know what goes into it.
Team mentality at that point, because you got to have a lot of faith and trust in your front of the house management and service team, and let them, and hopefully they can be the mouthpiece for what you're trying to do, and articulate what you were trying to do in the kitchen right here at the dinner table.
And that's tough. It's tough to get people to buy into what you're doing. It's, you know, we pour a lot of passion into what we do, and it's not every day you have a staff full of people that have that same passion. But I think you hit it on the head.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was updating my Instagram. So that's an example of
it. Yeah, so, but you know, you kind of hit it on the head with in sushi, you can kind of rely on yourself, and you can take it on your own shoulders, and you prep your own stuff. You have your own station. You control your area. Where we're at now, you're only as strong as your weakest link, and it's up to you to create those strong links and build people up and give them the morale and manage them personally, if you know, according to how they need. So.
Yeah, and I have to say, just looking at front of the house at 18 Seaboard, it was actually the first restaurant I ate when I moved to Raleigh. My boss at the time took me to dinner there, took me and my wife, and to echo Max's points, who was at the bar to greet us when we there? First person was Chef Jason Smith, which was pretty cool. Like, oh, you own this place and you're there greeting us. But in the 2 years plus that I've been coming there and doing staff trainings and just eating there, I haven't seen much turnover in the front of the house staff either. Maybe like one or two key people, but otherwise it's been maintained very well. So I think that probably also speaks to your guys' business model and the attitude there.
Continuity is key right now. In the city, there's definitely a labor shortage and crisis, and attracting the best people and trying to create an environment they want to stay. And we lose folks, and if you're moving forward, I'm going to embrace you and help you all you can. If you're moving sideways or backwards because you don't want to push yourself as hard, then I wish you well and move on. But you know, I would say we have a pretty good continuity company wide. And in management, we are really good at keeping folks. I added up all the years of 18 restaurant group management, but there's 21 managers front and back right now, and it was some really crazy high number. And there's not a lot of things I'll brag about, but our managers are real passionate and good, and they understand our clientele, and they understand each other. And mentoring managers is something I tried to get really good at 5 or 6 years ago, and that's something I want to continue to study and get better at throughout my career, and you know, find what works. And it's going to change too. You know, who you're talking to and trying to connect with is going to change, and that's something I've kind of worked on the last 2 years, is how to make a connection with somebody who's 26 years old. Yeah. Even though I feel like I'm still 26, I look like I'm 90 to those people sometimes now, you know, and trying to relate to those folks.
You actually look brand new, to be honest.
Well, I appreciate it.
You're a young-looking guy.
So all that stuff is, you know, something that I think we have to continue to study and work on and get better at.
Do you have any key tips, takeaways that you would like tell Jake or tell another fellow colleague who's opening up a business in restaurants?
It's hard at the beginning because you don't know what you're going to do or how your P&L is going to look. But as you get some consistency going, I think some type of shared and, you know, what we have done at Seaboard that's worked, or at all four locations, is to have a percentage of sales be a part of the salary. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not foolproof by any means. There's 100 different ways to do it. You know, at Seaboard, it's even more complicated because we can have busy months. The restaurant's so old, and you can have 4 or 5 repairs that are mind-boggling expensive. Mm. And the restaurant could actually lose money on a financial period, even though it was busy and customer satisfaction was high. But you're still giving these managers a percentage of sales. It's not a percentage of profit. There's two different things. So, that has been, I think, a good way to open their minds up. And, you know, when you're getting your butt handed to you, you're not just looking at the owner and thinking, oh, the owner's getting rich. You're actually getting a piece of that night of sales.
I love that.
Yeah,
incentivized.
It works.
Yeah,
incentivized. It works. And you know, it's that's been effective, but retention – the other retention, and this is a secret, it's kind of, I guard this one a little well, won't
Max,
be anymore.
Max, you want to play the drum roll?
Yeah, but it's not that big of a deal. But the quality of life schedule that I try to have with us is to offer and guarantee 2 days off a week, and also we have a day shift. I don't want to be in a restaurant five nights a week anymore. I've got other things I need to do and fun things and work things. And being there five nights, especially in a row, is really hard on your personal life. So we throw a day shift in there. So you come in one day, depending on the shift, it could be from 8 to 5 or 9 to 5, which in the restaurant world, that's like a kind of a wussy day right there.
Yeah.
You know, not taking away from anybody else's career path, but 9 to 5 is like a joke.
Yeah.
And some of them it's like 10 to 3 or 10 to 4. So that day kind of breaks up the work week. And I believe that has been one of the single best factors. You know, I love Magnolia Grill, but one of the things I didn't like is we were open five nights a week and you were expected to be there those five nights.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they had a small team. So it's not like someone subbed in for you. That was the team.
It didn't happen. That's right. And that worked really well for them, and I was okay with it. But when your buddy asks you to do something on a Saturday night and you say no, and then he asks you to do something the next Saturday night and you say no, well, at that point that buddy's going to start looking
for other
somebody,
buddies.
Yeah, other buddies. There's not personal, and that happened to me in my 20s. Not just the Magnolia Grill. It's because I chose an extreme life of going to work in New York City and things like that. And it happened those first 2 years that I opened 18 Seaboard because I was there so much of the time. And I feel like there's a little piece of me now that resents that. And I'm like, dude, I am not going to do this for another 25 years. I want to do some fun stuff too. And that quality of life has been, I think, a really good way to retain managers.
That's cool.
And yeah, it's been.
So if you're a manager or an employee at 18 Seaboard, you can pretty much expect to work 5 days, 4 of those being night shifts and 1 being a day shift.
That's right.
That's 50, cool.
50 to 54 hours.
That seems is a ballpark. Super doable, yeah, and in quality of life.
Yeah, and nowadays,
obviously that changes depending on busyness and stuff like that, but as a general rule.
Yeah, sometimes I get to put you where you want to be, and
right.
sometimes I have to put you where I need you to be.
Right.
Yeah. And those I have to make those calls sometimes, and they're not that fun to make sometimes, but most of the time it's everybody's kind of where they want to be and need to be, and it's going along pretty good, and it's working out well. And you know, it's most painful when you're having to pull somebody out of something they've worked really hard at, and then that starts crumbling a little bit, but I need them so badly at this other thing that is going to completely sink the ship if that thing doesn't get taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to explain that to them because they've taken this other thing and made it into theirs, and it's made it really good. I mean, an example of it right now is Josh at Harvest, man. That guy's the GM there, and he's done an excellent job. The restaurant's busy, lots of regulars. And he is now at the new cantina full time, and I needed him to go over there and get that thing where it needed to be. And he's done a great job at it. And, man, that is – you talk about a risky, hard decision, man. What if I sent him over there and that thing doesn't start doing well, and then this other thing doesn't start doing well – and then the whole thing's all crumbling to pieces. I don't have the bandwidth to just, you know, prop these things up month after month, you know. But knock on wood, the two guys at Harvest are doing great. The chef at Harvest was the original chef at Seaboard, Ty. He's doing great. The restaurant's having its best year ever in its third year. And poor Josh is having to go over there and clean up a big pile of crap at Cantina at Park West because it's a brand new baby. It's
figurative, not
yeah,
actual.
Not actually. Well,
it's like changing diapers.
Exactly. Yeah. The analogy I will use is it's a new baby, and a new baby is not fun, man. You're changing diapers. It doesn't sleep when it wants to.
Yeah.
You don't know when it's hungry. Yeah. But you get a restaurant that's doing what it needs to do. It's using the bathroom where it needs to. It tells you when it's hungry. You can reason and rationalize with it. Well, that's a four-year-old. A four-year-old's a lot of fun. A five-year-old's a lot of fun. An infant's not fun.
Yeah.
But Josh has got the skill set and the bandwidth to go and handle that infant and make it into a five-year-old.
That's awesome.
You hook him up with a lot of Johnson & Johnson baby powder and some Boudreaux's butt cream, and away he goes.
Yeah. And you thank him every time you hang up the phone with him.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. I'm sorry you're having to go through that.
So I want to touch on something and move along here because aside from Seaboard, and you touched on something about staffing, I know you're also part of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Plus, in a minute, I want to get into, Jake, what you're doing with the whole school lunch program with Chef Sean Fowler, et cetera. But in the next couple of months in Raleigh, we are going to have an infusion of probably 30 new food establishments with two food halls coming up, and then the reinvention of City Market.
But first,
yeah,
a quick word from our sponsor.
Chef Jason Smith's take on the influx of restaurants in Raleigh, coming up.
Yeah, but we'll take a quick break to talk about Triangle Wine Company, which is a fantastic wine retailer. They have three locations, Southern Pines, Morrisville, and Cary, and they also have online business as well. So you can go to trianglewineco.com, order all of your beer, wine, even just like your bar accents, like bitters and vermouths and all that. That's what I use all the time for my back bar. You can create an account, throw in all in your shopping bag, and it gets delivered to your place. If you're in the Triangle area, it's really the most convenient way. The best part is if you listen to the show and you like alcohol, which is probably
a good bet.
Probably most people who listen to the show like alcohol. Use the promo code NCFB and you get 10% off all of your purchases because you're a supporter of the show. And they, the Triangle Wine Company, are a supporter of our show. And so we love working with them. You'll keep your eyes out for when we do events with them as well. But go to Triangle Wine Company either in store or online.
Well said. All right. So now back to my question to you is, with this influx of restaurants and what's going on in downtown Raleigh, I hear from chefs and restaurant and business owners all the time about trouble staffing, especially back in the house. Nobody can get a dishwasher, these things. How, one, are we going to find the staff for all these restaurants? And then two, how is the people of Raleigh going to support going to all these restaurants?
How are we going to find customers?
Yeah, how are we going to find customers?
Well, first of all, there's always going to be more seats than there are customers, and it's my job to get them in the seats. It's my team's job to get them in the seats. So if I'm in a manager meeting and a new restaurant opening up has a reasoning why we may not be hitting our goals, then our job to just be better and make sure we're taking care of the customers. And in the time that we've been, we have seen, it's more, when I say bar crowd, I don't mean people having drinks. I mean people that eat at our bar, they are more likely to move around to the new spots.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll see them leave, and sometimes you'll see them leave for a year or two, and it's hard. It's not easy. It hurts your pride. But what I've been able to kind of try to focus on with the management team is when we see them return, let's make sure we're taking the best care of them that we can. You know, make sure they understand we got this new dish on the menu, or, you know, we've done this or we've done that. And, you know, so I think that, you know, I think thinking there's too many restaurants, man, there's always going to be too many restaurants. You show me a land where there's not enough restaurants, I'll pack up as quick as I can and I'll go move there. It doesn't exist. So that's not.
Because are you still part of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance?
I am. I'm okay. On the board. I'm outgoing. This is my last year. I've spent 7 years on the board.
Okay.
And I was on the executive committee and I actually chaired the board for 1 year. I was treasurer and chair, and then the outgoing chair. And
boy, you really can't sit still.
It was a great experience. And when I got on the board, I actually they didn't say this, but it always felt like they had a restaurant person. And I rolled on the board behind Niall, which was pretty awesome because, you know, he wore like
that's sweat. Niall Hanley, yeah. Who's opening Morgan Street Food Hall.
Yeah, and you know, this is a board that has like U.S. Josh Stein was on the board, who's the Attorney General now, and Marianne Baldwin, and you know, you got Niall in sweatpants and dropping F bombs in the board meetings, which was pretty cool. But with an Irish
Matt,
accent,
you should be on that board meeting.
Yeah, it's but you know, if you have an Irish accent, you can drop an F bomb.
Right.
It sounds really smart. When you have a Southern accent, you sound like a dumb redneck. So I didn't drop many F bombs, but I felt like a pretty great responsibility falling in behind him because he had done so much and had such an impact and is such a great business guy. And but really, when I got on that board, networking and learning from these folks that are more from white collar, highly educated positions, it was such a great learning experience. And I've made some friends and mentors. So it was one of those things where the more I got involved in it, the more I was getting out of it. And we also did some good work. And we also, when I started on that board, we were our conversations were, man, how are we going to get people downtown? And it transitioned to, oh my God, we got too much noise on the streets at 2 a.m, you know. And it was like, and it happened so quick, it kind of caught us blindsided. We didn't see it coming. But the time on that board was something that I'll be very dear to me, and it will also help me to be able to do more in the community going forward. The skill set that I got out of that, I plan on using more to help people further down the road.
Do you think, and this goes for both of you guys, do you think that the Triangle, and even more specific Raleigh, since we do have these two impending food halls coming, do you think Raleigh is ready for all of this?
I That food, that Morgan Street Food Hall looks cool, man. I've been to food halls across the country. I'm a little bit regretting I didn't get involved with that food hall in some regard. But
I have a feeling there'll probably be an opportunity somewhere.
Yeah, I know. We've talked a lot.
There's going to be some turnover.
There will be. There's going to be fallout for all kinds of things.
It's going to be like Normandy for like the first couple of weeks.
And the thing about that, though, is you know, I tell these guys, like, make sure that when you make the mistake or whatever you think's great doesn't work, it doesn't sink your whole ship. This is a business that even the best fell at. Mm-hmm. Danny Meyer, the greatest restaurant in my restaurateur of all time, in my opinion, even had a failure.
Yeah.
Tabla didn't work. He said he could keep Tabla running for 100 years, but it wasn't fair to the staff or to his company. And, you know, they pulled the plug on it. So even the best fell at this.
Yeah. And he sold EMP, you know, so.
Whatever happened there, we'll probably never know. I mean, it's a pretty crazy story, whatever. We can speculate. But, you know, so. You know, you go do a food hall and something, it doesn't work. We pull the plug on something. You know what we're going to do? We're going to go roll our sleeves up and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just I can't go $4 million in debt and then sink the whole ship. That's what I can't do.
Right.
You know, and if, you know, it's going to hurt and sting when it happens. And sometimes you close these things down on a high note. Magnolia Grill, Nana's. I mean, they were in complete control of those situations, but they ran their course.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the Nana's is profitable doesn't mean you need to keep it open forever.
Right.
Right. It's why Seinfeld did nine seasons and was like, I'm going to go out on top.
Yeah. What I know you guys are both involved, but Jake, you're really been named in this school lunch program with the North Carolina PTA,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So can you tell us a little bit about this and how it's helping kids and
definitely and
everything?
Yeah, definitely. You know, proud to be involved with that. Myself, Reagan Stackler, Bo Peterson from Primal, and Sean Fowler from Mandolin. We were given the opportunity to go to Southern Season and basically portray our idea of a modernized, chef-driven kids' lunch, school lunch. You know, I have a child. She just actually finished her first year of kindergarten. Well, kindergarten, she's going into first grade now. And I've gone to her lunchroom a couple times, and it's you know, quite repulsive what they serve our kids.
Mm.
And I think that they could do a lot better. I think they could reach out for a lot more resources like mm-hmm. chefs that are passionate about things like that. And it was really eye-opening to be there with a lot of people from the different district boards and hear what they have to say about the efforts they are giving for this and how the state's just not necessarily providing what needs to be provided for our children. And I think it goes without saying that our children, not only mine, but the entire generation should be our number one investment. I mean, I think we should be investing into our children and setting them up for success. Another thing that really, really caught me by surprise is seeing the separate lunch line for children whose parents cannot afford for them to have the lunch card where they get their same lunch every day.
So and
they serve
a
completely different set of food for these children who
really?
Might not
talk
whose parents
about
might,
segregation. Jeez.
Yeah, and it really kind of took me back, you know. And so that's another thing. I think that we owe it to these kids to provide them with the absolute best, most nutritional, exciting food. For them to have it at school. I mean, that's a sanctuary situation all the way
like
around.
It's like you're creating a rift between people in general.
Segregation,
and you're dividing the lines at childhood. That's just like, has history taught us nothing?
No, it's right. Like literally going back to 1960s. Yeah,
it's
50s.
No good, man. And basically the way they worded it in the package that we got at the beginning of the year was a very soft way of wording it, but it was clear, you know.
Like, do you want to pay for the premium lunch or do you want
right,
to just have the
or
regular?
This will be provided, you know. And I went then it kind of clicked a little bit, but then when I went and saw that there was an actual separate line that these kids had to go up to and basically just get handed a plate, you know, when my daughter's going through a line and getting to pick what she wants to get.
This
you know,
is
that's,
2018.
Yeah,
what
it's
hell
not,
is happening?
I don't know where the disconnect on that decision was, but, you know, so all of that going on, it's something that I feel like there's no reason for me to not get involved. I was thankful enough to get the opportunity and be asked to be involved. And now that I am, you know, I've made it known that anything that I can help with, any district that I can help with, any kind of instruction that I can provide, because there are districts that are sending their quote unquote lunch ladies, who we all know and love to classes, two instructional skill building classes to teach them knife skills. There's not even knives in the kitchens. And you know, they all wear gloves, they all wear hairnets, they all have hundreds on the wall because they open cans, they heat up, and they pour in a bucket. And that's not what our kids deserve. So
this program is not only teaching and educating school lunch ladies to cook
correct.
Better and cook more nutritionally, but is it providing better produce as well? And subsidizing
produce in general,
or produce in general, but also subsidizing so that those kids who are not fortunate enough to be on the, let's just call it for lack of a better term, the premium quote unquote lunch
right.
line, are they allowed to now make the same lunch available to everybody? Is that what this program is about?
So basically, we're trying to provide information that can be taken to legislation and try to ask for more money, mm-hmm. for a higher budget, to allow more instruction for the employees, to allow.
Asking the state for more budget?
Correct.
Okay.
The North Carolina PTA is. So they asked us to get involved and kind of help them make a presentation to the state,
mm-hmm.
And say, this is what we can do with X amount of a budget raise. They're trying to, in more rural areas, get farmers involved. And obviously, in the future, hopefully, in all areas, get farmers involved and kind of like you were talking about, the stuff that doesn't make it to the grocery store, doesn't
make
it to the market.
Yeah.
Let's kick that
calling
down.
Calling them out right now.
You know, so things like that. And there's only so much we can do, but if we can provide this information and say, hey, look, this is what it's going to look like if you move the number this much, it's a big difference.
Well, you know? I think that this is something that's important, and I hope people are outraged while they're listening to this right now, so much so that they actually get off their ass and do something.
Yeah, definitely.
But, you know, this is our country. This is our state. We have elected officials that we put there, and so we have to make them accountable for the things that they should be doing. Clearly, right now, we need more funding for our food program for our children.
Absolutely.
That's where the separation is coming in, because if your kid's going to a public school and food is going to be provided, it should be equal to all.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something we can all agree with. So Chef Stephen Devereaux Green, who will be a future guest on the show, he's the chef at the Umstead. We were talking, he was at Thrive NC, and he was on a panel, and the lady that, you know, to her credit, she's in charge of the Wake County school lunch program, and she said, look, we get like 78 cents per kid a day for food to spend to make the food. Now, I mean, could you guys make a good meal with 78 cents, even at the cantina? I mean, you know, like whatever you do. No, you can't.
And we were given $2 is what our theoretical budget was.
And that's tremendously larger,
and
you're still probably having to cut corners to make it right.
We were, but there, you know, you have fresh avocados, fresh produce, fresh, you know, it's a major difference, especially with the buying power the state has. I mean, with that much of a, you know, almost a dollar and a half raise on the budget, you could do a lot with that, man.
Everyone needs to be very aware when you vote and when you think about what you're voting. If you have kids, if you don't have kids, if you have nieces, nephews, whatever, you were once a kid. Think about what it was like when you were a child, and make that a conscious effort in your minds when you're voting and when you're thinking about policies that are happening. That is important. I get super frustrated about these things because we have kids that are starving. We have produce that's going to waste. We have schools that are segregating lines. I mean, this clearly is just a program or a process that needs to be addressed and corrected. So
in line with that, if people want to get involved with this program, to people that are listening, how can they help?
I would say reach out to Marion Wint, who's on the head of the board for the North Carolina Parents and Teachers Association. She played a big role in she was our liaison between between us and the district boards, and she's basically fighting every day for this type of stuff. She's got some children of her own, and you know, with they're hoping to take what we've provided and say, this is an example of what can happen if we get this for our budget. So reach out to the North Carolina PTA. You can follow them on Instagram. You can direct message them on Instagram.
It's just NCPTA.
Mm-hmm.
Google that.
And you can feel free to reach out to me any way you want to, and I'll get you directed.
Go to 18 Seaboard and come Jason Smith and Jake Wood.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Need all the help we can get for it.
Yeah. Well, gents, we appreciate it. Thank you so much. What's your Instagram handle, or what's the best way to reach out, like for social media for the restaurants and for you?
At 18 Seaboard, and then my personal is just at Chef Jake Wood.
Chef Jake Wood.
Mm-hmm. You can message on both. We answer.
Blow them up.
Yep.
Well, Matt,
Well, guys, thank you. This has been a great local story of, like I said, you went to Apex High School. You grew up in Raleigh, so local boy has done good. If you're in the area, go to 18 Seaboard, go to Cantina, go to Harvest 18 of the South Point Mall, and you will eat and drink very merrily.
Guests of the NC F&B podcast receive a swag bag, including gifts from these exceptional North Carolina producers: Social House Vodka, Hungry Harvest, Alley 26 Tonic Syrup, Larry's Beans and 42 in Lawrence, and Michael's English Muffins. Thanks for listening to the NC F&B podcast. I'm the voice, Brian Hoyle. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.